The session we're going to start deals with emerging technologies and energy storage. And our first speaker is Mike Oster from EOS Energy Storage.
Hi, my name is Michael Oster of EOS Energy Storage. A pleasure to speak with you guys. Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks to Dan and the Sandia team. I'm going to be speaking about a zinc air electrically rechargeable battery system that we've developed and we're in the process of commercializing from our labs in Easton, Pennsylvania. First, I want to give a little bit of background on the market. We've all seen a lot of presentations that show that the market is big. And in fact, some of the people on the stage earlier today showed some of the numbers on the top left of the slide. The market size numbers in the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars are realistic, but there's some realistic bases for those numbers. However, it should be understood that the market only becomes large when the costs are low. If you look at this chart at the bottom, which is an EPRI chart, it shows the value of each of the services that batteries or energy storage technologies could provide to the grid. And at the roughly $1,000 per kilowatt hour capital cost, you'll see that it's a several gigawatt market for some of the regulation and other high-value services. But it only becomes a 40-plus gigawatt market in the U.S. alone when you start approaching the $160 or so dollar per kilowatt price. And that's the price that we're targeting. To compare the cost of our system, we think that it's best to use levelized cost, because levelized cost per kilowatt hour delivered during peak times, it takes into account not only initial capital cost, but it takes into account life, it takes into account efficiency and maintenance and operating cost. And based on the projected life of the electrically rechargeable zinc air system that we've developed, we think that we're already below the cost of a peaking turbine per kilowatt hour delivered over its life. And that, again, takes into account efficiency and cost of inputs. If you see the chart on the left, at pretty much every cost of natural gas and at every cost of off-peak electricity that would be the inputs, the system that we've developed, we believe, is less expensive. If you've seen some of those round charts that show the size of the energy storage market in the globe, you'll see that the largest circle is generally pumped hydro, and there's a reason for that. It's very low cost. In fact, it's understood that in the U.S. there may not be many more pumped hydro projects developed, and the reason is because anywhere where you could have developed a pumped hydro plant in an economically viable way and place, it probably already was developed. We believe that taking into account, again, efficiency losses and costs and real estate and other cost factors and life, that our system is also less expensive than a pumped hydro plant and starting to push the costs of a combined cycle gas turbine. So just for a quick summary before I get into the technology a little bit, of some of the competitive advantages of zinc air generally and in some cases inherently and in our specific iteration is capital cost, and you'll see on the first chart both cost per kilowatt and per kilowatt hour. We believe that we're a fraction of the cost of some of the other leading technologies. Inherently, zinc air is more energy dense, and in a moment I'll show you why that's the case, but especially at the system level, because when you have a safe and stable system, you're able to save a lot of space and a lot of volume. We believe at the system level, compared to a lithium-ion battery and even compared to a lead-acid battery, we're pretty close to an order of magnitude more energy dense. Safety is another consideration. We have a novel electrolyte that is not potassium hydroxide. It's neutral, and it's safe and stable, and there's nothing flammable in our system. So safety is another area where we very specifically targeted and believe that we've developed some competitive advantages. And finally, an area where zinc air has generally not been considered one of the leaders is cycle life. We have, you'll see from the chart on the bottom left on the screens. So far, we're at about 2,000 cycles. Those are all full depth of discharge cycles, 100% depth of discharge cycles. And at the end of those roughly 2,000 cycles, we've thus far achieved no physical degradation and no performance degradation so far. So that we believe that because of our materials, because of our architecture, because of some of the other components and designs, that we have resolved the electrical rechargeability limitation of what is one of the least expensive and inherently one of the more compelling energy storage technologies. Just a quick word about about electric vehicles. Because our system is low cost, because it's energy dense, because it's safe, it has interesting applications for electric vehicles. And if you look at some of these numbers, we're comparing our statistics to the United States Advanced Battery Consortium's goals. And some people will tell you that the goals aren't necessarily realistic. They represent like-to-haves as opposed to realistic potentials over the near to medium term. However, we believe that we've achieved or surpassed and have come pretty close to most of those goals, especially with regard to energy and volume and cost. And some of the other technologies will have a very difficult time achieving some of those costs. Zinc is costs about $2 per kilogram, and you have about a kilowatt hour per kilogram. So the cost of the energy storage media of a zinc system, not only a zinc air system, is very low cost inherently. And if you could have a safe and stable and low cost box with minimal overhead around that, then you have the potential to achieve some of those low costs. Now, what's interesting is if you pair an energy battery, a long life, energy dense energy battery such as ours, with some of the power batteries, such as advanced lead acid or lithium ion, you have an interesting combination where you achieve some of the costs that you need to, but also in a space and with a weight and with surge capability and acceleration capability that you need for an electric vehicle. Just for a moment, for those of you that are not familiar with zinc air, in concept is a box where all of the space and weight and just about all of the materials are used as the anode, in other words, for the energy storage. So you don't have the overhead of having to carry your oxidizer or your cathode reactant on board. You absorb the oxygen in ambient air. So as a result, if you look at the image on the right, that's a zinc air battery, and the pinhole, this is a micro cell or a if you've seen the hearing aid batteries, you peel them and start letting the oxygen through. So that pinhole lets the oxygen through into the air electrode, which enables it to be used for the conversion or plating of zinc metal. And the micro battery on the left is an alkaline battery. And you'll note that the anode represents about 60% of the space. In a lithium ion battery, the anode is about 30%, you know, in rough order of magnitude of the space. And so you have a lot of overhead. And the images at the bottom are intended to illustrate that a car is actually a gasoline air engine. It needs a ton of air to combust the roughly 20-gallon tank of gasoline that you have. And every other battery is that image on the bottom left, which is a car pulling a ton of air in a trailer, and only a metal air battery is the image of the vehicle by itself. Some of the achievements that we've accomplished relate to architecture, relate to electrolyte composition, relate to electrolyte management and operation of the batteries, and relate to materials, and we'll show you a little bit more about some of these, and manufacturing process and scalability. And as we mentioned, we've achieved so far a couple thousand cycles, and we're not estimating that we expect a long life, potentially up to 30 years and 10,000 cycles, because we've achieved 2,000 cycles, nor is it because we've achieved 2,000 cycles at full depth of discharge with no physical degradation. It's because of the inherent nature of the materials that we've used. Some of the other achievements are low-cost materials with no noble metals, and a couple of interesting inventions that I won't go into detail on today, but relate to the efficiency. Metal air batteries, one of the shortfalls is total efficiency, round-trip efficiency. And we believe that we've accomplish some ways to make that efficiency considerably higher than industry norms, and we'll show you that in just a moment. In addition, because we have a safe, neutral electrolyte, the system and battery management system and other requirements result in a safe battery. Some of the problems historically of zinc air is that the system absorbs CO2 and it forms hard carbonates that clog the pores of an air electrode, resulting in failure. We do not absorb CO2, and therefore we don't clog the air electrode pores. We also, because of our electrolyte, do not form dendrites. We have an electrolyte management system that enables the battery during normal and aggressive operation and duty cycles to not dry out. We manage the expansion and contraction as zinc plates and dissolves in a similar way with our electrolyte management system, and which is integral to the system. And some of the other factors that result in a shorter life and other failure modes, we believe that we've resolved with architecture, with materials. We've eliminated the use of a membrane. That's one of our patents that's already been issued, is an inert current collector that makes it so that the system does not need an ion selective membrane or even a separator. I'll go into a little bit of detail on some of the aspects of the invention specifically. One is related to the materials, that not only do the metals that we use not corrode, but they don't oxidize, which would result in a non-conductive coating, which, again, would cause failure over time. This is an image of an expanded metal screen, which is the current collector in our air electrode, magnetized, I believe, 100 times. And this is after some hundreds of cycles, and thus far we've seen no physical degradation on those materials. And again, that's with deep discharge, with 100% depth of discharge. The capacity after some of these charts are a few weeks old or a few months old, the capacity after 1,600 cycles, and in fact after 2,000 cycles, does not degrade. Thus far, there is not a noticeable degradation at all after these number of cycles. And regarding the efficiency, I'd like to note that this is voltaic and Coulombic efficiency. That you're not supposed to get this kind of high efficiency. Granted, it's at slightly lower power, but we're starting to push the power up. But we're achieving very high round trip efficiencies because of some of the inventions that enhance the air and other materials that are being used. You'll note that during the hurricane in the Northeast, we're based in Eastern Pennsylvania. During the hurricane, some of the load cells that we used to test our systems lost power, and when the power was restored, they put a constant surge for the rest of the weekend into the battery, and would have fried most other batteries. But ours has some self-healing effects and functions that we've integrated into the system, so it came back at pretty much full efficiency. The slide after this one, I'll show you a summary of some of the specifications and costs. But I'd like to note that the costs or the price that we project to be able to sell the zinc air system into the market is $1,000 per kilowatt with 6 hours of storage. So that amounts to $160 per kilowatt hour, and that's for the DC battery system. That's based on a current density of 50 milliamps per square centimeter, and the potential current density of our materials is 700, and in fact, on discharge, it's more than 3,000. So, but if you use the 700 milliwatt number, and with our voltage, that almost equates to the milliamps, we're at in the order of magnitude of about 1/15th of our potential theoretical limit that would enable us to sell the system at these costs, and the images at the bottom are of a 50 kilowatt, 300 kilowatt hour module and a 1 megawatt system that has 6 megawatt hours that will fit in a 40-foot shipping container. Again, it's safe, a very long cycle life, and has an interesting manufacturing scalability such that with a low capital investment, we think we'll be able to scale up a large number of these in the next year and a half when we start manufacturing. Thank you very much.
Chair from Aquion Energy Systems. And just a note, we'll leave 20 minutes at the end of this session to ask questions of all the speakers.
Thanks. Thank you. I've got a healthy number of slides. I'm going to go really, really quickly through some of them and focus on some other ones. I just want to acknowledge collaborators and our source of funding. Thanks, Imrie, and some very good venture firms that have been really helping supporting us, getting us out of the lab and into the real world. So this talk is in part about describing the what, how this came to be, why it matters to us, and we show a fair amount of data here. I believe it's really important to share, especially for a new technology like this, show the data, show the voltage versus capacity profiles, prove that this is legitimate. There is, in our opinion, a lack of honest data a lot of the times for new technologies. So I really want to, at least in this case, I want to share as much as I can. So as you know, cost is everything. Efficiency is very important. And the size constraints for any given application, they vary. But and this is to mirror other people's values. If you can get below $200 per kilowatt hour, there's a lot of interest. It's a very, very big market. So the take here, and as Professor Huggins said earlier, and others are talking about a lot now, are neutral aqueous electrolyte systems. It should be cheap, right? We don't have organic solvents. We should have much more efficient ionic conductivity in aqueous electrolyte. That should allow thicker electrodes, and that should also be simpler to manufacture. So in principle, it sounds interesting. And of course, aqueous electrolyte batteries are not new. They're the oldest kind of batteries. But specific here that I want to talk about are intercalation-based electrode systems, intercalation being the mechanism that also occurs in lithium-ion batteries. It's known to be much less degradative than what you would find in more traditional battery chemistries. So that's really the question. What about intercalation-based neutral pH aqueous electrolyte batteries? So yeah, it's not a new idea. Lithium-ion folks have looked at this over the past couple of decades to various levels of success, although in general the cycle life that they were able to get out of these systems are relatively low. So the challenge is to make this much higher cycle life with very low-cost materials and to do that in a very thick electrode format. So the first thing, what about cost? I mean, what about other sort of new chemistries? And sodium has better ionic conductivity in water than lithium does for a variety of reasons. It's basically a free cation for us to imagine using. But we need a cathode material that can handle sodium in an aqueous environment. So this is one of our first innovations. Of course, not a new idea either, sodium-ion batteries. Research for decades, most of them are either high temperature, like the sodium sulfur system or the Zebra battery, or are based on organic solvents, like you find in lithium-ion batteries. And typical results were that this is more rate-limited lithium-ion batteries and demonstrated in a variety of cases, but not as a cyclable aqueous electrolyte system. So our first hit was this cathode material, Na4Mn9O18. It's got this funny microstructure, and I'm just going to skip through this really quickly. This electrochemical data, the peaks on this curve on the left side show that we have real redox couples occurring in this material and that it's very cyclable, which is a really interesting hit for us. And so we need something to put on the other side of the battery, though. And it turns out that most of the degradation that we've seen in these kinds of systems occur at the negative electrode. They occur at the anode of this battery. And for a lot of reasons. It depends on how you count things, but it's basically corrosion. And it turns out that carbons are very, very robust in the face of this kind of corrosion, and so we start with looking at carbons. But you need a very low-cost carbon. Turns out most of the carbons for electrochemical double-layer capacitors are extremely expensive, tens and tens, up to $100 a kilogram, which is absolutely out of the ballpark for the kind of problem that we have. So this is some results that we are taking very low-cost precursors like sugars, like corn syrup or molasses, and doing some processing and getting to very high capacitances. in excess of, this shows about 200 farads per gram. We've made it up to 250 farads per gram. I will say that our carbon process now is very different than this, but this is a very similar performance. And something else I should note is that we get even higher capacitance values when we cycle this material at the very low voltages associated with the negative electrode of our device. There's a lot of interesting reasons why that happens, and it really takes us to a place where you wouldn't necessarily imagine being able to take carbon and water. Up to 70 amp hours per kilogram against our manganese oxide system. So here's the basic device, sodium manganate. Why manganese oxide? Because you can start with electrolytic manganese dioxide, EMD, and you can do it for very little money. And activated carbon as the negative electrode. And put it in sodium sulfate, 1 molar. And this was the first set of results we got. It was relatively rate capable, not great. I mean, not as interesting as the Prussian blue result we heard about this morning, but interesting. And it was also very, very cyclable. So this really proves out the idea that if you can do an intercalation cathode, and if you have a stable carbon at the anode, you can cycle this nearly infinitely. And this is 1,000, but we did 5,000 and beyond in this system and others. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, this material did not have enough energy density to justify our cost proposition, right? We needed more dollars per watt hour, fewer dollars per watt hour to make this work. And so the next interesting hit on the cathode side was the cubic spinel lambda manganese oxide material. And it turns out that you template this when you make it with lithium, but it functions perfectly well in a sodium sulfate environment. Even if you remove all the lithium from the system, it still functions perfectly well. And it gives us much higher specific capacity. And here, this is in watt hours per kilogram at a cathode basis, and it's over 100 watt hours per kilogram at C over 10 to C over 20 rates. And at intermediate rates, multi-hour rates, it's still very good. And because we're targeting an energy market, multi-hour charge, multi-hour discharge, this material is very appealing. So we end up putting a little bit of lithium carbonate in the system to make it, but at the end of the day, we get much, much more energy out of it. And the overall cost, given the glut of lithium carbonate in the market right now, is actually very, very low. So this material also, here's 5,000 cycles, nearly perfect coulombic efficiency, very stable. Again, this is a rapid cycle, but it's a very thin electrode system, so we're exercising most of the battery. And the next piece then is translating that interesting primal result, thin film, coin cells, basic materials work, translating into something that's commercially viable. And the key to this is creating very thick freestanding electrodes that are manufacturable and inserting those electrodes into a useful package that can be also inexpensively manufactured. So this is an interesting proof that we can now make multi-millimeter thick electrodes very rapidly, and I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. We are able to do this at over 40 watt hours per kilogram of material and greater than 90% round trip energy efficiency, which is very important in all respects. So this result really triggered the spinoff of the company Aquion Energy out of Carnegie Mellon, because all of a sudden we really believed that we had something that was a legitimate and could be a going concern. Unfortunately, this is a movie, but unfortunately, every time I try to play this on a PC, it doesn't work. But on the left are the electrodes rolling off of our automated electrode press. Now we can make hundreds and hundreds a minute. They roll off of the press in two different conveyor belts, and we can collect them in a variety of ways. These will eventually feed directly into an automated electrode stacking system. And on the right is how we make these batteries right now. And it looks very different. Actually, this picture was taken over the summer, and it's much different looking now. And we're in the process of replacing people with automated systems. But the idea is every person has one layer of the battery, and the battery cases themselves go around this dial table, and you build up layer by layer the battery until it's done. Right now, we're able to manufacture in this way in a very simple pilot way is 2 to 3 kilowatt hours a day if we put our minds to it. And our units are bigger than these. These are very small units you see in this picture. And here they are. This is what we call battery zero. It's not meant to be a product. This is designed to be a proof of concept from a manufacturability and prototypes way. It's a great teacher for us. Battery one is being designed right now. It's going to be coming out sometime mid to late next year. This unit has just under a liter of electrode space inside of it. It gives about 30 watt hours of energy, In the lower right shows the energy density as a function of discharge. Now, remember, again, our goal is not to do a power only or very high rate application. We will be doing energy. Now, if we do energy, we can also do power, provided the power to energy ratio of our unit doesn't exceed a certain value. So there's a lot of interesting dual use cases where we can do a variety of things, and I'll show some data to support that in a minute. In general, if we are longer than 3 or 4 hours on a charge discharge, we believe we're economically viable. You can put these together, as you can imagine. These are some interesting just games that you play to put these together and appealing packages one way or another. It's cheap and fast. There's a discharge from it. This 8-cell unit is about a 15-volt full state of charge unit. Here's some more cycling data. Is this robust? Right? This is from large format batteries now. Thick electrodes, large format, again, not coin cell data. We see very repeatable charge discharge. This is voltage versus capacity, voltage versus time with the current denoted. And again, very repeatable. And here's about a year and a half of cycling. This is at 700. We subsequently took this battery out to at least 1,200 cycles and increased the rate, and it's still going. Very, very stable performance. And this performance also, these units were sent out to KEMA for validation. I've got some data from them to show as well. What about high voltage strings? One of the systems level implications of this chemistry is that we don't need a significant amount of battery or cell level management electronic-wise to maintain a high voltage string. We've got a lot of data to support this claim, and here's some examples. There's a string of 60 batteries at over 110, 120 volts. The lower left is pretty compelling data as well. It shows a string of 10 batteries that we are charging to higher and higher voltages. And if you do the math, you realize that we're at 1.8 volts, a full state of charge for the first 30 cycles there. Again, no capacity fade. This is aqueous electrolyte, 1.8 volts, neutral pH. So you can play some games with the electrodes and some additives in the electrolyte and get to very high voltages without having degradation or side corrosion. This is an important message. And again, the data show, it speaks for itself. We have shown the stability. 1.9 volts per cell, 2.0 volts per cell, still stable. So if you spec out this battery at under these voltages per cell on a string, and you are careful with how you understand the performance and overcharge conditions, specifically at the anode, we're able to have very little BMS with a very stable string. This is also an important slide. This shows high temperature cycling and also stand at partial state of charge under high temperature conditions. So this is 850 hours through 100% depth of discharge deep cycling, and then we let it stand at open circuit for 40 hours. So 75% DOD for 40 hours, and that's that sort of upper left blue plot. You see the current goes to zero, and the battery then goes to about 1 volt, which is its open circuit state of charge. And then we resume the same cycle, again, the same temperature. And the data on the right shows that the battery was completely stable through this exercise. And there's a lot of battery chemistries that have trouble with either partial state of charge stand or high temperature cycling. Again, the data here are showing we've got this robust system that is able to overcome these harsh conditions. We believe this could be a very interesting prove out for example, off-grid solar or other places where you do deep cycling and stand at partial state of charge a lot, sometimes in very hot environments. Here's a picture of some of our early test units at KEMA, all sensored up under cycle. The data are kind of interesting. So this is a roughly 1C wind support. The lower left data is a coulombically neutral four-hour cycle where the same number of electrons are passed in and out of the battery over every four-hour cycle. The upper left is the voltage response of the unit, and the lower right is the many repeats of this exercise, and you see that over a lot of this, there is no drift in the average voltage of the battery. This means again that we are having a coulombically neutral or a very efficient system, and it's able to even at this relatively high rate for our device, it's able to handle the necessary power for a wind application. And we do even better in peak shaving, which is an 8-hour charge and 16-hour discharge. Very easy for us to handle that very low polarization on the battery. And again, you see on the lower right, the energy as a function of time delivered by the battery is very stable over many, many hours. Again, data collected at KEMA, verified third-party data. So where are we right now? We are starting to tool up a little bit more. We're making, as they say, multi-kilowatt hours a day. By mid to early Q2 next year, we anticipate to be taking a major step in creating many more of these batteries in a semi-automated fashion. We're also currently trying to site our factory, and we're growing like a weed. We need people. If you or you know somebody who is interested in this kind of technology, check out our website. We have over 30 job openings. We are doing the best we can to accommodate this rapid growth. The technology is supporting our growth. We need people to support the technology. You can read through this as well as I can, but very soon you will see more data from us and some installations, some early installations, and we hope to follow it up with substantial manufacturing capabilities sometime in late 2013, early 2014. So this is a summary. We think we've got a game-changing technology. We've got very low-cost materials. The genesis of this idea ought to be clear now to you how we thought about doing this and what it is that we're doing. We think we have a very compelling value proposition and a handful of target applications. We are selling to very small numbers this year and selling larger numbers next year and hopefully have sort of a more factory-like production scale by 2014. And we're engaging a variety of people already. And if you're curious about the technology, please come talk to us. Scott Pearson and Ted Wiley are also here. Scott's our CEO, and Ted is our VP of Market and Business Development. Please come talk to us. And this last slide, too, just shows we have one of our battery arrays out on the roof in Pittsburgh getting hot and cold. It powers our sign at night. And, again, the real-life data shows that thermal cycles and lots of cycling and deep cycling are fine for our battery. So, anyway, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
The next presentation will be on thermal energy storage as an enabler, presented by Paul Denham from NREL.
Thank you. So I guess I should start by saying that when I started working on thermal energy storage about 2 years ago, I kind of regarded it as similar orphan stepchild of the storage industry, kind of like solar water heating is to the PV industry. So, but the CSP team at NREL kind of beat up on me for a while and said, you know, you really need to look at thermal storage and how it can be an enabling technology. So that's what I've been doing for the last year or so. And just provided today an overview of some results, results from the CSP aspect of it. Now, I've also worked on ice storage in buildings. Fortunately, I won't be able to really talk about those results today, but it's in the paper, and we've got other publications forthcoming on that as well. So we've had some interesting results from our look at thermal storage. Okay, so bottom line, second bullet point, 17% of potential wind generation curtailed in 2009. Okay, so that's real energy that did not go into the grid because of constraints in the system. Now, the primary constraint was transmission, okay? And, you know, there are some storage options for that as well. The folks in the CASE community have been talking about how to relieve transmission constraints. Much of these are in West Texas, and I think there are some options there. But increasingly, it's going to be flexibility constraints in the grid. It's really going to be the fact that you've got coincidence limits of the wind and demand patterns. And bottom line is that the wind is somewhat anti-correlated with load, the idea that wind tends to blow more at night during the day. So the other issue is the flexibility of the existing grid, the existing generator mix that's meeting the residual demand and the increase in operating reserves required from wind and solar. Those flexibility limits are going to create increasingly challenges for using the solar and wind that gets placed on the grid. So we need to understand how we can increase flexibility of the grid. And a lot of times I think about energy storage as that option. Okay, so to kind of emphasize this is a result of some simulations that we did a few years ago just to provide some background. And this is the good day. These are four levels of PV penetration on the same day. This is simulations in the Western U.S. grid, results shown just for the California mix. And you can see the far left one is no photovoltaics. The far right one is 10% photovoltaics on an energy basis for the entire year. So it's not 10% on this day. It's 10% for the entire year. And this looks great. PV is doing a great job of reducing the need for actual physical hardware as well as avoiding the highest cost peaking units. So this is the good news. This is the exact same simulation just on a different day. This is a spring day, and this is the bad news. So take a look at what we're doing here. PV has essentially completely displaced all of the imports from California, and California is now a net exporter. And this is with only 10% energy from PV. Now, we're nowhere near that, obviously, but I think lots of people in the solar community would love to see this. 10% is not too aggressive, I think, to be thinking about as a source of energy. And this is going to present significant challenges towards grid operators. Again, we've turned from a net importer during the first and last part of the day to a net exporter of energy. This is going to cause some significant challenges for grid operators. The other issue here is the same results. This is a ramp duration curve. If you've seen a low duration curve, this is the same thing, just for ramp rates. And again, typical peak hour or a high ramp hour in the California system, you're looking at about 4,000 megawatts of generators per hour. At high penetrations, we more than double that ramp rate. So again, combination of ramp rates and this just supply-demand coincidence is going to cause significant challenges. Kind of looking broader, WECC-wide. So this is a WECC-wide simulation on a early summer day. And for those utility operators in the room that have nuclear plants, I want you to take a look at what we're doing with the nuclear plants. Go to your nuclear plant operators and ask them whether or not that's realistic. And I think they would say no. We're cycling our nuclear plants. And that's not something that a nuclear plant operator is going to want to do. Also look at the coal plants. It's always hard on dispatch decks to see kind of what's going on, as you kind of move up the dispatch stack. But we are cycling the heck out of these coal plants as well. We're not decommitting them because you can't do that, but we are cycling them down to their min-gen points every single day, and they're not going to want to do this. So the question is, can we use all the solar and wind energy that we're trying to put onto the grid? Back before we had negative LMPs, I used to love showing this slide. I think most of you have seen something like this now. Below-cost bids, now negative LMPs, just reflecting the fact that we do not want to turn these plants off. We do not want to do deep cycling of our coal and nuclear plants. And we're seeing below-cost bids, and indeed we're seeing negative LMPs in multiple locations in the U.S. With the existing wind penetration. That's all only going to get worse. And this is just showing you a reduced form dispatch. So we're stripping out all of the generator data here so we can kind of see this a little bit clearer. You've got a 20% contribution from PV, and this is a Western Grid simulation now. And you're basically seeing we're pulling our units down to their min-gen points, taking a look at what the standard databases of min-gen points on your thermal generators can do, and you're saying, okay, if we can't cycle our units down to that, either because of the technical constraints of the generators or the fact that we need operating reserves to provide flexibility, to provide ramp rates, as well as address the uncertainty of the solar and wind resource, we're going to start curtailing more and more energy. We're getting a 20% contribution from PV here, and we're throwing away a fair amount. So the light area above the top of the curve is essentially PV that we're rejecting from the system. And given the relatively high cost of PV now, we certainly do not want to reject PV generation, as we also do not want to reject wind energy from the grid as well. And we're doing that. And given these flexibility limits, we will do more of that as the penetration of these renewable sources increase. Translating that into what does this actually mean in terms of as we increase penetration of the grid, what's the cost implications going to be? At low penetration, we know that we can use a lot more renewables on the grid. If we deal with these transmission constraints, classic transmission constraints, West Texas to East Texas and other locations, we can certainly use most of that wind energy that we're currently rejecting. Likewise, solar energy, especially if it's distributed, located near energy, we're not going to have near loads. We're not going to have transmission constraints, but we will have these flexibility constraints. This is a curtailment rate of PV as a function of penetration in the western U.S. So this is a WECC-wide simulation showing you that, again, kind of those old rules of thumb about 10 to 20%, penetration limits. I think those are a misnomer. There aren't hard penetration limits, but what we do see is we do see economic challenges that do start to happen in these 10 to 20% ranges. And this particular case, I'm showing the marginal or incremental curtailment rate as well as the overall average curtailment rate of photovoltaics as a function of penetration. The bottom line is somewhere up to 10% or so, we can use all this PV. But flexibility limits in the existing grid, thermal generation, min-gen constraints, or in California they call it overgeneration, where the supply of renewables exceeds what you can use because you're backing off your thermal stations to their minimum generation points, we start throwing away more and more PV energy. We simply cannot use this energy because there's no place for it to go. There's no demand for this. Surprisingly, there's not enough demand for electricity even in the middle of the day. This primarily happens in kind of the late spring, really nice sunny days, maybe not a whole lot of air conditioning in the kind of 10, 11 a.m. hour. We cannot use all this PV generation. And this is highly nonlinear. The more PV we put into it, you're already saturating demand in that middle of the day. You're just going to saturate it more and more. These curtailment rates go increase dramatically, as you can see. Let's turn that into some dollars. This is the curtailment cost impact. If you're trying to sell energy at 6 or 10 cents per kilowatt hour, if your capacity factor goes down because the curtailment rate increases, you're going to have to charge more money for the energy that you can sell. This is the multiplier to the LCOE of PV that would result from all this curtailment as a function of penetration. And what you can see is, so it starts with 1, that's the base multiplier. So if you've got a PPA for PV at 12 cents per kilowatt hour, as you curtail, you're going to have to charge more for the energy that you can sell. And you can see that those multipliers increase rapidly. Now, again, we're talking about penetration numbers that are way, way beyond where we're at now. We're well under 1% penetration for PV. But if we do get low-cost PV, as we've got a new aggressive goal at the Department of Energy, the SunShot program, to try and get installed costs down to $1 a watt, and if we can get those kinds of numbers, I think PV would be a really exciting technology to see large-scale deployment, and we can start thinking about double-digit penetrations. I don't see any reason why we can't think about double-digit penetrations of photovoltaics. The limiting factor is going to be this. If we can't use all that photovoltaic energy and because of these increased costs due to curtailment, we have to think about what we're going to do to accommodate all this energy. So that's kind of the background of this. So the way that a lot of us at NREL think about this, and increasingly I think in the utility sector, is this concept of a flexibility supply curve. And that's the suite of technologies that can increase the flexibility of the grid. Now, electricity storage technologies, I think, is the biggest hammer, quite frankly. It is the most powerful technology, but it's currently encumbered by both high costs and a relatively low round-trip efficiency. So, again, we talk about curtailment of wind energy being 17%. Well, if you put wind energy into energy storage, you're effectively curtailing 20% of it. So I think electricity storage is certainly the biggest hammer, but I also like looking at other enabling technologies, and this gets back to looking at thermal storage in various forms. So the two technologies that I've been working on recently is thermal storage and CSP. Advantage of storing thermal energy, of course, is you store the energy before you take the Carnot hit. You can get really high round-trip efficiencies, actually above 95% round-trip efficiency, because you just get a little bit of losses in the heat exchangers and a little bit of losses in the giant thermos that you got outside storing all this thermal energy. Relatively low costs, under $80 per kilowatt-hour electric. Big limiting factor, of course, single application. You can't store wind with this. You can, but the round-trip efficiency of that would be really low. You really have to store thermal energy before you put it into use. Cold storage in buildings, another interesting application. Again, very high round-trip efficiencies, typically well above 90%. You got to make that cold anyway. You're just going to make it in the middle of the night or earlier, store that cold energy, and then use it again. Again, huge disadvantage, single application. You're only going to use this for air conditioning. It's not going to do you any good in the winter. Early spring, especially some of these times in the spring where you get lots of wind power. So again, limited application there. But the high efficiency and relatively low cost, intriguing for enabling renewable energy. Okay, so looking at, for instance, dispatchable CSP, to look at kind of frame this about its usefulness, first thing is you can move energy over time. And this is a fairly straightforward application, fairly obvious. The two traces down at the bottom represent the dispatch of CSP both without storage and with storage. So you're seeing the blue line, it would be a CSP plant without storage, red line with storage, showing you're moving energy towards the end of the day. Now, if you think back to an earlier slide, I showed that CSP has limited, or PV has limited correlation with demand patterns. This allows you to move your CSP to the late afternoon, early evening, use the solar energy there, use your PV earlier in the day, And a combination allows overall increase of solar in general. But one of the primary things that are critically important to look at is the increased flexibility that you can get out of using CSP or other sources with thermal energy storage. This just shows how the curtailment rate of a combined CSP and PV would be much lower. So the blue line is basically shifting the contribution of solar to the right. That point where curtailment really starts to hurt you is moved over to the right. But what I really want to show is the fact that CSP allows increased flexibility in your grid. Now, I talked about these problems of thermal storage or thermal generators and their flexibility limits. And it's really based on two issues. One is the technical constraints on your minimum generation from your large fossil and nuclear plants. The other is the fact that you need to maintain thermal plants, and these can be combined cycle or even simple cycle gas turbines, to provide operating reserves for both the variability and uncertainty of the solar resource. So if you can replace either those traditional baseload sources with CSP or provide operating reserves with CSP, that can potentially mean you can decommit or replace traditional thermal generators with CSP. This is a heat rate curve as a function of part load for both simulated CSP plants based on some SEGS experiments, some early trough plants, as well as we just pulled the continuous emissions monitoring system data from a bunch of small steam plants. A ton of these were in ERCOT, but they're all around the country. And we looked at their heat rate as a function of part load, and they're pretty flat, down to 40-50%. This is better than a combined cycle. This is certainly better than a simple cycle CT. And so when we look at what you can do with a CSP plant in providing operating reserves, providing part load operation, they're really flexible plants. So if we can provide operating reserves with CSP plants, that may provide additional flexibility. So we did some simulations where we took the minimum generation constraints on the conditional thermal generators, replaced a bunch of them with CSP plants, and found that we had a much more flexible grid. We were able to add a lot more solar generation, but a lot more PV generation, because we didn't have all these thermal generators back down to their minimum generation points and still not being able to use all of this energy. So by providing flexibility from CSP with thermal storage, we could greatly increase the amount of PV that we could put on the system. Simulations of our ice storage found similar things as well. By being able to provide operating reserves with ice storage in buildings, we're also able to add grid flexibility. And this final slide shows you the overall impact of that. The black line is now the curtailment rate of a combined CSP PV system with these flexibility constraints. Reducing the flexibility challenges of the grid allowed us much greater penetrations of solar energy with much lower curtailment rates. And so that's the overview, and there will be more details in the paper. Thank you.
Gary Yang from PNNL to talk about R&D activities.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being patient for the last talk. I'll try to limit my talk in 15 minutes. I'd like to give you an update stationary storage research, development, commercialization effort at Pacific Northwest National Lab. First, I'd like to give you an introduction of the lab. Pacific Northwest National Lab is a major DOE office science lab. We have four missions. One of the missions is to increase U.S. energy capacity and reduce dependence on foreign oil. The lab has been managed by Battelle since 1965. In the past couple years, our R&D expenditure annually reach over $1 billion. Currently, we have roughly 5,000 employees, including 3,000 scientists, engineers. One of the thrust area in energy business is electrical energy storage, research, development, and commercialization. We have carry out a wide range of activities, including first, some high-risk, high-payoff emerging technologies, such as sodium-ion battery, hydride-air battery, We also carry out effort developing technologies which were invented in the past couple of decades, but are facing challenges to meet the requirement for broad market penetration. Particularly, the focus has been on planar sodium metal halide battery, new generation redox flow battery, and a unique lithium-ion battery for stationary applications. We are actively pursuing technology transfer to industry and work with industry commercialized technologies. Integrated part of overall effort is on grid analysis and cost modeling. At National Lab, our overall goal is to develop optimized cost-effective technologies for renewable integration and grid application. We are leveraging our expertise capabilities in material sensors, chemistries, and cross-cutting science, including computer modeling, advanced diagnostic study, and electrochemical characterization. But at the National Lab, at most, we can deliver a prototype. To be exact, it's a benchtop system. Beyond that, we have to work with the industry to manufacture real-size system and demo system, even eventually commercialization. Overall, the effort at the lab is guided by our grid analytics and cost analysis. The grid analytics task is led by Dr. Michael Kentemeyer. Actually, he's going to present details in Friday morning during DOE program review. Overall, the analytics help define the value, needs, and also requirement of electrical energy storage applications. If you have interest, please talk to Dr. Michael Kentemeyer. He speaks fluently, not only English, also German. Next, I want to give you a brief introduction overview of our technology areas. Start with redox flow battery. This task is led by Dr. Liu Li, who will give a talk tomorrow morning and again in Friday morning during DOE program review. The objective of this task is to develop new generation redox flow battery that
can demonstrate substantial improvement in performance and economics so as to accelerate commercialization and market penetration. To achieve this goal, we are collaborating with industries, university. For example, currently we're working on alternative membrane with Sandia, Penn State, and also University of Tennessee. We work with DuPont, Dramic, GraphTech, SGL to optimize components, including membrane electrodes. We also, in the process, license our technology to industry, work with industry to commercialize the technologies. Overall, our efforts include component cell research development, cell stack design, and system engineering. In the past couple of years, particularly, we made significant progress in redox flow battery electrochemistry. We developed third generation all vanadium redox flow battery, which demonstrates 100% increased energy capacity, 8% extension in operating temperature, basically extending the temperature from current technology about 10 degrees to 30 degrees, to 35 or 40 degrees, to a range from 5 degrees to 60 degrees C. We also achieve 8% energy efficiency at current density, twice of the current technology. Second system, we develop iron vanadium redox couple. The iron vanadium redox couple demonstrate excellent electrochemical activity. Same times, because the elimination of vanadium 5 plus, we can use low-cost membrane. That's just one example. We could use other low-cost components as well. Eliminate the gas evolution because the voltage, low voltage potential, and gas management. In the future, we intend to optimize cell component designs, scale up, demonstrate benchtop in this fiscal year, actually, early next year. Certainly, I mentioned earlier, transfer technology is an important part of our overall effort. Next technology everyone discusses is the sodium metal halide batteries. This is a task led by Dr. Vince Sprinkle and John Lemon. Vince is going to present in poster during ESET, and he's going to have an oral presentation in Friday morning during DOE program review. The objective of this task is to develop planar sodium metal halide battery to meet cost performance target for renewable integration and grid application. For introduction for new design, particularly we have interest in planar design and modification of electrochemistry and interfaces. This one is supported by both RPE and DOE OE. We collaborate with our industry partner, Eagle Picture. Overall, the effort covers research development component cell stack design, as well as system engineering. So far, we have proved the concept of the planar design, especially it's challenging to find the cells. We leverage our expertise in solid oxide fuel cell, found suitable cells. Already scale up to intermediate size, met major milestone of RPE project. Next year, it's planned to develop a demonstrate 5-kilowatt prototype, 2012. The third technology area is a unique lithium-ion battery for community storage. The reason I want to use the word unique, I want to emphasize our focus of lithium-ion battery effort. Instead of energy density, we focus more on low cost and high cycle life. This is probably the two primary emphasis for stationary applications. Particularly, we have interest in titanium oxide-based anode and lithium transition metal phosphate cathode. But these two materials may not have the electronic conductivity you need for the lithium-ion battery. So what we do, we synthesize composite of the electrode materials, make sure the electrode can demonstrate both good electronic and ionic conductivity. Indeed, we demonstrate 1,000 stable cycles with negligible degradation in capacity. We're currently making the full cell, real size cell, and continue to evaluate the technology. The final technology area is emerging technologies. This task led by Dr. Zhu Liu, our senior fellow. Dr. Yu Yuan Xiao going to report details during DOE program review. The objective of this task is to develop new concept that can lead to transformational improvement in performance and economics. One example is a sodium-ion battery. We found some electrode nanostructures that allow faster sodium transport intercalation and deintercalation. You heard what the concept intercalation, deintercalation from Professor G. Whitaker. Achieve stable cycle, 1,000 cycle at 0.5C, if memory correct, probably 25% capacity degradation after 1,000 cycles. We are working on anode side, try to find the novel carbon structure as anode. Eventually want to demonstrate the cell, scale up if the technology demonstrates good performance at a large scale. Here the acknowledgments, the effort was supported by DOE, OE, Emerjuke's storage program, RPE storage program, some small support from DOE BES, also PNL directed R&D fund. Like to thank useful discussion with Dr. Emerjuke, Dr. Mark Johnson, Dr. Dave Danielson. Also like to thank collaboration with my friends, Sandia, Ross, Karen, and the rest of the team. At PNL, Dr. Landis Kamberg is our business sector manager. He's in the audience. If you have interest in business side, please talk to him. We have a team, probably over 30 scientists, engineers, postdocs working on this area. With that, I'd like to conclude my talk. Thank you.
It looks like we have about 10 or 12 minutes left for questions. But first, I want to thank our presenters for putting together a lot of deep information and getting through it within the specified time. So thank you. Any questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
Thanks. Li Yili from Pacific Northwest National Lab. I have a question about the zinc air battery system. You are using neutral electrolyte, and what do you comment on hydrogen evolution during the charging and discharging? You know, also related pressure increase. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. For the pressure increase, we have an electrolyte management system that enables the electrolyte to overflow effectively without rupturing any of the systems. With regard to hydrogen generation or evolution, there are some ingredients in the electrolyte that eliminate it, that passivate it. As a safety mechanism, we also have catalyst caps at the top of each stack, which would reconvert it or recombine it back into water in the event that there's a battery management system failure that would cause some hydrogen generation. But we have resolved that, and I could give you more detail about it later.
Okay. There's a question up here. No.
Question over here? Paul, could you say a word or two about the capacity value of CSP with storage?
It's very high. I mean, it's close to 100%. I mean, if you schedule it properly, I mean, we were doing simulations with 6 hours of storage, and we were getting 90%+ on when we did our effective load carrying capacity calculations.
Okay.
Well, James, of the Optimal Power Solutions. A question to Paul as well. The cost of electricity going through the thermal process, what's the cost per kilowatt hour of electricity going through thermal process, through the storage process? And if so, why don't we use storage for an open cycle gas turbine? Why don't you use thermal storage on open cycle gas turbines?
So with CSP, it's really driven by the CSP technology, and currently CSP technology is expensive. I mean, the LCOE numbers for current CSP technology is 14 to 19 cents per kilowatt hour. So that cost has to come down for it to be competitive. I think part of the issue here is that we're really exploring is we're at a point now where PV is cheaper than CSP. So if you're talking about just on an LCOE basis, why would you ever build CSP? The point is you need to understand the value proposition for both. So CSP could be actually more expensive but still be desirable in the mix because of these flexibility benefits. But right now CSP is very high. And in terms of thermal storage from traditional all types of plants, I know that EPRI has done they did all this work back in the 70s and 80s, and I can't really comment in terms of why the economics of thermal storage for traditional power stations didn't work. But it is kind of an obvious potential application. My guess is just the additional cost didn't beat the relatively low costs of the power block and just putting a bigger coal pile in front of the plant.
Question in back?
Yes. Robert Shanker, EPRI. You're correct. Back in the 70s, 80s, we looked at dynamic benefits of energy storage and with or without thermal storage, and it was the added cost was the issue. My question, Paul, is a couple of fold. First, I want to thank you for an excellent presentation. And my question relates to the scenarios or the assumptions you used for the grid operator rules. And did you look at different load growths? Because there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of fuel costs and load growths and such in those great PowerPoint slides you showed. I was curious did you look at a variety of future scenarios? Because we don't know exactly what really will happen.
Yeah, so a lot of these simulations are based on a set of studies. I really piggyback off of these two studies. One is called the Renewable Electricity Future Scenario, which is looking at the grid going out to 2050 and looking at high renewable penetrations. Then there's something called it used to be Solar Vision, now it's the Sunshot Vision study. Both these studies should be coming out soon. And they looked at a variety of load growth scenarios, anywhere from kind of a zero growth all the way to kind of a business's 2% per year or something type growth. But I think that the grid operation piece is really kind of the more critical piece.
Yeah.
So essentially what we're doing in a lot of these studies is assuming either each interconnect or... At a minimum, each interconnect is acting as a single balancing area. Which is obviously a very aggressive assumption. It's not copper sheet. It's you know, we enforce transmission constraints, but it's essentially simulating each interconnect as if it was a single balancing authority and with real time power exchanges through some kind of either a 5-minute market dispatch or some better communication. In the Solar Vision and in the RE Futures, by the time we got to 2050, we were dispatching the entire U.S. as if it was a single balancing authority. So I know you can yell at me about that later, but it was an interesting experiment to see whether or not that would provide benefits.
That's a very interesting observation. Yeah. But what happened when you had all the three interconnects, assuming that they're all tied together, did it make a difference?
It does. It does. We see power flows going from west to east and east to west on each day. You see the swing. You'd be shipping solar in the middle of the day from west to east and then wind power from east to west across the interconnect. So we built a bunch of AC-DC converter stations, and we were shipping energy over large distances. Again, we enforced transmission constraints. We enforced transmission losses. But we essentially allowed real-time power exchange from Maine to California if the transmission was available.
Okay, last question, sorry. Did you present any of these results to the ISOs within California and other parts of the country?
So the ISOs have been part of the stakeholder. The biggest thing that we've been working on, which is I think a little bit less aggressive but probably more realistic, is the Western Wind and Solar Integration Study. So the ISOs and the utilities in the West were major stakeholders there and are also major stakeholders in the Phase 2 project, which is really looking at these issues around thermal cycling, because quite frankly, when we did the original study and we saw these coal plants that were cycling every day down to their min-gen points, the utilities freaked out. So we've been spending a huge amount of our time looking at constraints on thermal generators and interacting heavily with the ISOs and utilities on that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Question in the middle.
This is a question from Michael on the zinc air battery. Sorry if I missed it in your presentation, but what's the round-trip efficiency for the technology?
The round-trip efficiency... before we started to enhance and create what's effectively a hybrid zinc air system was in the mid-70s total Coulombic and voltaic efficiency. Some of the other innovations that we've recently developed in recent months at what I would characterize as low power, but we're starting to bring that up rather aggressively, but we're achieving in the low to mid-90s, again, total round-trip efficiency.
Thanks.
Any other questions from the audience?
Harish Kamat from EPRI. Sorry to burden you again with another question from EPRI, Paul, but my question was about the hydro that was in your model. Are you restricting the amount of the lower limit on hydro based on agricultural and environmental constraints? I noticed that was not moving that much in the model.
Hydro is really scary, and I don't know how to do hydro properly. That's my always defer. I mean, I defer to the folks at PNNL about hydro. But we were using the hydro constraints that were basically built into the production cost models. We're not experts at hydro at NREL on the actual constraints. And cascade hydro, I mean, that's a really hard problem to deal with. So we basically use hydro out of the box in the models.
Okay. Well, that'll conclude the morning session. Oh, is there one more question? Okay, well, let's conclude the morning session. We'll meet back here at 1 o'clock for session 6 on power electronics.